Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're going to be in Numbers chapter 13 through 15. And one of the things to keep in mind as we go through this reading here is, there but for the grace of God go I, is probably a good way to sum this up. Probably will be a little bit clearer as we get into especially chapter 14 of this. So chapter 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of your father's tribes, each one a leader among them." So Moshe sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord, all of the men, them men who were heads of the sons of Israel. These then were their names. From the tribe of Reuben, Shema, the son of Zakur. From the tribe of Shimon, Shaphat, the son of Hori. From the tribe of Yehuda, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. From the tribe of Issachar, Igal, the son of Yosef. From the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. From the tribe of Benjamin, Palti, the son of Raphu. From the tribe of Zebulun, Gadiel, the son of Sodi. And from the tribe of Joseph, from the tribe of Manasseh, Gadi, the son of Susi. From the tribe of Dan, Amiel, the son of Gamali. From the tribe of Asher, Shetur, the son of Mikhael. From the tribe of Naphtali, Nachbi, the son of Vophsi. And from the tribe of Gad, Geuel, the son of Malchi. These are the names of the men whom Moshe sent to spy out the land. But Moshe called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Yehoshua. Then Moshe sent them out to spy the land of Canaan. He said to them, "Go up into the Negev, then go up into the hill country. See what the land is like, whether the people who live there are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are the trees in it? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land." Now the time was the time for the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob at Libo Hamat. When they had gone up into the Negev, they came up to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmi, the descendants of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two men, with some of the pomegranates and the figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down from there. Then they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days. They proceeded to come to Moshe and Aharon and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told them and said, "We went in the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country. And the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moshe and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. But to the men who had gone up with him, said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we had gone in spying it out, a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who are parts of the Nephilim. And we saw and we became like grasshoppers in our sight, and so we were in their sight. Chapter 14. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moshe and Aharon, and the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Mitzrayim, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Mitzrayim? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Mitzrayim. Then Moshe and Aharon fell on their faces in the presence of the assembly and the congregation of the sons of Israel. Yehoshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. The Lord said to Moshe, how long will this people spurn me, and how long will they not believe me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. But Moshe said to the Lord, then the people of Mitzrayim will hear of it, and for by your strength you brought up this people from their midst, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people, for you, O Lord, are seen eye to eye, while your cloud stands over them. And you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of your name will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness. But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers unto the children to the third and the fourth generations. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you also have forgiven this people from Mitzrayim even until now. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory, my signs which I performed in Mitzrayim and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Now the people of Amalek and the people of Canaan live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. The Lord spoke to Moshe and Aharon, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses will fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land which I swore to settle you, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Yehoshua the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said you would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they will know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses will fall in this wilderness. Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness. According to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they will die. As for the men whom Moshe sent out to spy the land, and who returned and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing a bad report concerning the land, even those men who brought out the very bad report of the land died by a plague before the Lord. But Yehoshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh remained alive out of those men who went out to spy the land. When Moshe spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people mourned greatly. In the morning, however, they rose up early and went up to the ridge in the hill country, saying, "Here we are. We have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord promised." But Moshe said, "Why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord, when it will not succeed? Do not go up, or you will be struck down before your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. For the people of Amalek and the people of Canaan will be there in front of you, and you will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned back from following the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you." But they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant, nor of the Lord, nor Moshe left the camp. Then the people of Amalek and Canaan, who lived in that hill country, came down and struck them, and beat them down as far as Hormah. Chapter 15. Now the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land where you are to live, which I am giving you, then make an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow or a freewill offering in your appointed times, to make a soothing aroma to the Lord from the herd or from the flock. The one who presents his offering shall present to the Lord a grain offering of 1/10 of an ephah, fine flour mixed with 1/4 of a hin of oil. And you shall prepare wine for the drink offering, 1/4 of a hin, with the burnt offering or for the sacrifice for each lamb. Or for a ram you shall prepare a grain offering, 2/10 of an ephah, fine flour mixed with 1/3 of a hin of oil. And for the drink offering, you shall offer 1/3 of a hin of wine as a soothing aroma to the Lord. When you prepare a bull as a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow, or for peace offerings to the Lord, then you shall offer with the bull a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah, fine flour mixed with 1/2 a hin of oil. And you shall offer a drink offering, 1/2 of a hin of wine, as an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus it shall be done for each ox or for each ram, or for each of the male lambs or for the goats. According to the number that you prepare, so you shall do for everyone according to their number. All who are native shall do these things in this manner, presenting an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord. If an alien sojourns among you, or one who may be among you throughout your generations, and he wishes to make an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord, just as you do, so he shall do. As for the assembly, there shall be one statute for you, for the alien who sojourns with you, a perpetual statute throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the alien be before the Lord. There is to be one law and one ordinance for you and for the alien who sojourns among you. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, When you enter the land where I bring you, then it shall be when you eat the food of the land, you shall lift up an offering to the Lord. Of the first of your dough you shall lift up a cake as an offering. As the offering of the threshing floor, so shall you lift it up. From the first of your dough you shall give to the Lord an offering through your generations. When you unwittingly fail to and do not observe all these commandments which the Lord has spoken through Moshe, even all the Lord has commanded you through Moshe, from the day when the Lord gave command and onward throughout your generations, then it shall be, if it was done unintentionally, without the knowledge of the congregation, that all the congregation shall offer one bull for a burnt offering as a soothing aroma to the Lord, with its grain offering and its drink offering according to the ordinance, and one male goat for a sin offering. Then the priest shall make atonement for the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, and they will be forgiven. For it was an error, and they have brought their offering, an offering by fire to the Lord, and their sin offering before the Lord for their error. So all the congregation of the sons of Israel will be forgiven, with the alien who sojourns among them, for it happened to all the people through error. Also, if one person sins unintentionally, then he shall offer a one-year-old female goat for a sin offering. The priest shall make atonement before the Lord for the person who goes astray when he sins unintentionally, making atonement for him, that he may be forgiven. There shall be one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is native among the sons of Israel, and for the alien who sojourns among them. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be on him. Now while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Shabbat. Those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moshe and Aharon and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because it had not been declared what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moshe, The man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moshe. The Lord also spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tassel on each corner a cord of blue. It shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot, so that you may remember to do all the commandments and be holy to your God. For I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Mitzrayim to be your God. I am the Lord your God. Okay, that is the segment here today. Are there any questions or comments as we get started? Observations? Well, I guess we're just going to have to... Yes, okay, we have one down here. So we have a question down here.
It says the inhabitants of the land will eat you up. I have some ideas. I'm just wondering about yourselves. And if I have another question, I will ask if it's okay. Just the inhabitants of the land, and also that... The Israelites had came against God, right? I mean, they after all that they'd seen, their sin was that they turned on God, right? It's not that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, we're going to get to that, and that's a really big theme because
this section here,
chapters 13 and 14, are ones that are hugely pivotal to pretty much the entire Bible.
Right.
You'll see them referred to again and again throughout the Psalms. You'll see them referred to throughout the prophets, and you'll see it referred to a few times in the apostolic writings as well. Right. So this is a hugely pivotal moment. The giants.
Men of renown.
Men of renown, yes.
You know, I just got a book about the giants, but the giants and renown. I just want to have your opinion on that, too.
About the giants?
Yeah, and because, I don't think they're over nine. I mean, I don't think they're like.
Some of the descriptions you have later, they were later on in the writings.
Yeah,
they're definitely pretty tall. Definitely pretty tall.
Bill just brought me a book about the giants.
Yes.
So
there have been some pretty tall people throughout history, some of which we encounter even today.
Too. So you'll elaborate on the giants too, because I think it's just the men of renown between the sons of... That refers to back into Genesis, right?
Yeah, well,
that's referring there's
a key point to that that often gets missed as we talk about Nephilim.
Okay. All right, thank you.
I'll give you a hint. They lose. Any other points? Oh, yes, Bill.
That book I loaned Debbie, those are Texas giants.
Oh, the Texas giants. Okay, yes. They're bigger than the local giants, yes. Any other observations? Yes, John.
Participants, right after all the names. Yeah, there's a name change out of the blue, right?
Out of the blue.
I'm just curious about that.
Curious about that.
I see that.
Yes. It's a very curious change. Although, it's actually, the name change has a lot to do with what happens in chapters 13 and 14.
Okay, so you're going to talk
about
that.
Yes, okay, that's a very pivotal thing. And, because you'll note that when God decides to specifically change someone's name, that's something big is happening, and something big was going down. Any other observations? Yes, Pat, over here.
I'm curious why the punishment was so harsh for gathering the wood and to be stoned to death.
Yeah, that's a good observation because, one of the things we've mentioned in times past is there's been a circular. It started out by fax and then went by email and has now ended up on, TV and such like that. And among the lists of things that are mocking worthy in the Bible, that is among the list of things in there. And it's like, if I see my neighbor out mowing the lawn or gathering something on the Sabbath, do I go out and kill him? That's how it's been caricatured. So that's a key thing we're going to get to on this because it goes towards the credibility of God. And it's quite interesting that he says, the Lord says in response to this, because my name has been blasphemed. And we talked about blaspheming a lot, to make common the name of the Lord. So it's a big observation. It's like, what is the big deal? From the outside, you might say, well, what is the big deal? And we've seen throughout time examples of some pretty capricious despots who have just, whacked people on a whim for any and every reason. So is this an example of just a completely, dictatorial approach to God's reign, or is this some very, very, very important thing that is trying to get communicated here? And that's what we're going to get to. You presume right that it is something very important because I'll give you another hint. It comes up in Revelation chapter 13, and it's one of those key things that is kind of peeking at the back of the book, so to speak, but it's one of those key things that God tells us is going to be a pivotal thing coming down to the end of all things. That thing that you see going on there in Numbers chapter 15 with the sticks on the Shabbat is actually you could say, behind what is some of the final things that people fight against God over. So very, very interesting. So any other observations, things that we should be zeroing in on before we get started further? Okay, well, first we'll go into the observation that we had here at the outset about this name change. So we got these 12 people who are named specifically going through, and the one that is named from Ephraim coming in as named as Hoshea, the son of Nun. And then later on and down in Numbers chapter 13, verse 16, it says Moshe called him Hoshea, the son of Nun, and it called him, changed his name to Yehoshua. Or as it's listed there, it says Joshua. That comes over from the Septuagint, because that's how it's rendered. It's Yehoshua there in the Septuagint. So that's how it comes over as Joshua to us today. But kind of going through some things on Hoshea, which is the name it starts out with. Hoshea is a word that specifically means salvation or deliverer, and comes from the verb yasha. And the verb yasha is something that means to make something wide or to make something spacious. So that's how we get the idea that Hoshea means salvation. It means that to make it wide, to make it spacious, to give you enough room to be in. So that's what you're saying about deliverance. You're being delivered to some place that's got enough room, has got enough resources for you to do what you need to do. That's kind of what's behind the term Hoshea. It's also Hosea, as it's rendered in the Septuagint, the Greek version, which is, you might recall, is also the name of one of the prophet, little minor prophets there in the back. Not minor in his task or his message, but minor in the size of the book. And back there, it was all about an adulterous people and having to, basically, the terrible object lesson and mission that he was assigned to do as part of his prophesying, the message he was given, was to go marry an adulterous woman, to marry a harlot. So kind of interesting that this story also here involves a harlot. And kind of interested, we'll get to that a little bit later, of the picture that we will see. It's actually from the Haftarah for this portion over in Joshua chapter 2, with an account that happens much later in Israel's history. But it kind of dovetails nicely into this. It's a nice bookend, because this is, again, in Joshua chapter 2, a spying experience, but it's like quite a bit later, 40 years later than what we're reading about in this passage. So more on this name change. So with Hoshea, and name is changed to Yehoshua, or where we get changed to Joshua. Now, Hoshea, there is the term that of salvation, to make wide, to make plentiful. So Yehoshua is adding the term Yah in front of it, and Yah is short form of Yahweh or Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, basically God's name. It's a short form you see in prophetic books and in poetry of a shorter version of God's name. So thus, it's like God saves. So it's gone from salvation, you know, to make wide, to make plentiful, to God saves, God delivers. So, in this account, what do you think is the importance of that name change? And then, kind of, since we've been round and round this book before, and the Bible before, what do we see later on that happens with this guy that he does? What does he do? We'll read about it in a later passage. He's the one who delivers the people into the land finally after the death of Moshe. So he's the one who leads them in. But the point is getting across with this name change, is who is actually delivering them? Yah is delivering them. And that's the big point that they're trying to get across with this. It's like, yeah, okay, this guy is going to be the instrument to take them into the land that's spacious enough for them to be in, but he is just an instrument of the one really doing the work in that. Yes, yeah. Oh, okay. So, and an extension of this that we have is, you see it quite a lot throughout the Bible, is Yeshua. And Yeshua being a form of this, with the, you know, got the extra hey on the end, or kind of the transliterate is an H on the end of it. And that's often translated as salvation. You'll see that throughout the Psalms. You know, you have become my Yeshua, you've become my salvation. That is another expression of that original verb there of Yasha. Now, the extension of it down, and you start seeing later on in the later writing books and also in the prophets, you'll start seeing this name, several people have this name of, it's spelled in your Bible Jeshua, but it's Yeshua, and has that spelling of the Yod, the Shin, the Vav, and the Ayin. And that spelling then gets carried over into later times. You see it transliterated as into Greek as Yeshua, and then later you see it in history as Jesus. In the apostolic writings, translated Jesus, and that's where you get the spelling Jesus from, is from Jesus. So, dealing with the same name here. Now, it's great, as we were talking about the derivation coming all the way down from Yasha, is to save, to bring in, to deliverance and such. Now, the fun thing about the name Yeshua is that you can actually kind of think of that with two different meanings. It can also, it can be a meaning that, okay, if you're taking it as a shortened form of Yehoshua from, you know, God saves. Because you see that kind of explanation in the apostolic writings when the Messiah is, they said, this is going to be his name. You see that, that meaning there, that Yah saves. But you could also read that as a kind of a masculine future form of the verb Yasha, which means he will save. So it's kind of a, you can read that name two different ways, is Yah saves or he will save, which gives a great picture of the present and the future salvation that God brings, the deliverance that God brings, the bringing you into a place of well-being. It's not only some off, we're off in the future, but it's also now. And it's not just now, it's also in the future. So some of what you see in the prophets of these, the salvation that is coming in this messianic prophecies, that looks like, oh, it's only referring to the time period that the prophet is writing in, but there's also little markers in there that point to something that happens way off into the future. This kind of gives you that dual picture, that the one who saves now and the one who will save at some point in time. Meaning that this is not just a temporary passing deliverance, which is something that's also kind of big, that gets into where we'll be going off into the future with the discussion of Hebrews chapter 3 and 4, when they're talking about entering his rest. This is not like a revolving door on his rest. This is a going in and dwelling there. Rest. Staying. You're putting down roots. That's where you're actually going to go. Kind of another observation from the section here that's starting out where the spies are going in and going through the land. It talks in verses, in Numbers 13, verses 23 through 24 about Eshkol, the big cluster of grapes that they're carrying between two people, and being huge, huge cluster of grapes. Now that's something that's just quite amazing, you know, since we live in wine country, to think of a cluster that big. Because around this area, if you talk to a lot of winemakers and they get huge, big clusters, sometimes that's not such a great thing. But for this picture, the sign of abundance is huge. Because you see this picture show up quite a lot in Israel's history with the prophecy that comes in later about, in Deuteronomy, about when Because at the end of Deuteronomy, as they're getting ready to enter the land, one of the things they say is that you will drink, because you drank the foaming fruit of the vine. That's another picture. When they say flowing with milk and honey, a description of the land, another one is that it's got lots of grapes. Grapes are everywhere. And that came down later into this picture of grapes that are so big and so abundant that they can fulfill all the needs of the land is something that came down into some of the later writings sages came across. Now, for example, one section from the Mishnah talks about, in the world to come, a man will bring one grape on a wagon or a ship. Okay, so that's obviously a great exaggeration, but the picture is that the Messianic era is going to be described as having this grape, the fruit of the vine, is going to be enough to supply everyone. And just one berry of the cluster is enough to fill everything. Another description here is from one of the commentaries, the Numbers Rabbah, describes as, in the world to come, the Holy One, blessed be He, will make a banquet for the righteous in the Garden of Eden, and He will give them to drink wine preserved in its grapes since the 6 days of creation. Wow, that's quite the preservation process. But the idea is that what God is going to provide, these grapes being a symbol of the abundance of God in the Messianic era, that this is going to be more than enough. A little will go a long way to doing that, which should start making your wheels start turning here about something you might have recalled from John chapter 2. About the wedding in Cana, about turning water into wine, because these things are recorded here, date somewhere around the first century. Some of this stuff you can't really be totally sure of on when it was written, but it's pretty early in the kind of the, you would say, rabbinic writings, the sage writings. So somewhere around the first century, these sorts of, you could say, predictions, legends of what the Messianic era was going to be like. So for the Messiah to come in and take water and make it into wine and the best wine ever, more than enough than they needed, that was quite a sign. It's described in John as it was one of the signs that he performed. So for people who are looking for a Messianic era with lots of wine, well, there it is. And he made it out of water. So not bringing a grape over on a ship, but this is making water into wine. That should give you a picture of what it is that God was looking to do and to show that He was going to take them to a land of abundance. So they bring in this big cluster of grapes. And sadly, that wasn't the only thing that they brought in. They also brought in what's called the bad report. And the bad report that's described in there in verses 23 through 33 in Numbers chapter 13. And they just talk about these people are big. You got the Nephilim, you got the Anakim, all these people of great renown and fear. These are people that are utterly fearsome. And some of what has been kind of dug up related to these cities, especially, you know, Jericho or Jericho, you can see that those walls at that point in time were pretty formidable. But they've dug up around Jericho. Those walls at the time period were massively thick. So you think you're coming out of the desert and you're going in and you're looking at this land and you compare what resources you have and then you look at what you're going up against. It's unbelievably formidable what you're going to go up against. So, do you think that you can do it, or do you think you can't? And they come back and they're like, wow, these people are fearsome. We can't do it. But you have the ones that do stand up, you've got to describe there of Caleb. Or he stands up and says, yeah, they can do that. And described later on, and as you get into Joshua chapter 11 and chapter 14, that's Yehoshua and Caleb, They go in and they take those very cities that those other 10 were so scared of. So they believed that God was going to do that. They ended up having to wait 40 years to see that actually happen. I mean, think about your own life. For those of you who aren't 40 yet, to think of 40 years ago might be a challenge, but if you think about a long, long time ago, as far back as you could possibly think, something happening and then not being able to see anything actually result from that for a long, long time period later. Now, lots of our lives, we think things are just not moving, not moving, not moving. 40 years, 20 years, 10 years, how long that can take for you to see something happen. Are you going to trust that it actually is going to happen? That something is going to happen because of it? And then again, thinking it may not even happen in your lifetime, but can you actually trust that God is going to bring it to a completion, bring it to a good completion versus a bad completion? That it's actually going to be something that resolves. You think of family members who, quote, don't get it, unquote. Those things you just may not see in your own lifetime. But you trust God that it actually is going to happen. But now it's time for the Haftarah, or little detour. Going to the same place, but 40 years later. And this is in Joshua chapter 2. So we're going to take a look at the bookmark back there in Numbers. We'll be back there shortly. But let's take a look at Joshua chapter 2. Then Yehoshua, the son of Nun, sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and they came to the house of a harlot, whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. It was told to the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from." It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. "I do not know where the men went, but pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. But before dawn, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Mitzrayim, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. Now therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers and sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." So the men said to her, "Our life for yours, if you do not tell this business of ours. And it shall come about, when the Lord gives us the land, that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. She said to them, "Go to the hill country, so that the pursuers will not happen upon you, and hide yourselves there for 3 days until the pursuers return. Then afterward you may go on your way." The men said to her, "We shall be free from this oath to which you have made us swear, unless when we come to the land You tied this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down to gather yourself and gather yourself into your house, your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household. And it shall come about that anyone who goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head. But we shall be free. But anyone who is with you in his house, his blood shall be on his own head if a hand is laid on them. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be free from the oath which you have made us swear. She said, according to your words, so be it. So she went away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and came to the hill country and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now the pursuers had sought them along the road, but had not found them. Then the two men returned and came to down from the hill country and crossed over and came to Yehoshua, the son of Nun. And they related to him all that had happened to him. They said to Yehoshua, surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands. Moreover, all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us. So one of the things that you note here in this passage is that these two spies came to, as is described in Hebrew, is the Beit Ish Zonah, or the house of the woman of harlotry. And the Zonah there specifically is a form of the verb that means, literally means to be highly fed, or another, it's used often as a euphemism for promiscuousness. So that idea of being highly fed is what the root word of Zana means. So her name, Rahab, means to be expansive, to be roomy. Boy, does that sound familiar. Yeah, Yasha. That's the root meaning of Yasha, is to bring into an area that's roomy. That's the root meaning of deliverance. So this woman of was described as bad morals was the method for bringing deliverance. Now it's interesting, the various levels of deliverance here. This was deliverance of, you could say, deliverance of the two spies, but also deliverance of her own household. It's kind of, because remember, if you hit the rewind tape a little bit, that this was happening right around the time of Passover, with the crossing over of the Jordan to head on into the land. And it's interesting that you've got some of the imagery or the themes of the first Passover coming out of Egypt with this. You put this scarlet cord in your window, and as long as you stay inside the door, nothing is going to happen to you. Now, the nothing that's going to happen to you was like, you know, much of the city falling down, being shaken to pieces, and then the army coming in over the top of the gates to do the cleanup afterward. Now, that's quite the astounding. We talk about the wrath of the Lord coming through, the destroyer, as it was in Mitzrayim on that first Passover. Well, this was quite the destroyer that went through Jericho. Because I can tell you, it wasn't because of shofars blowing that those walls came down. So, you know, as they, you look back and what archaeology dug up of the walls of Jericho, and they were, for the time period, compared to some other cities, they were pretty thick. Pretty thick walls. They were, yeah, they were very, well, that's like in Babylon, but Babylon, the walls of Babylon were big enough where we could ride chariots, you know, along them on the top. But these were pretty thick comparatively for what you were finding in some of the other cities. But those all shook down and fell down there in Jericho. So that picture of deliverance, so she was an instrument of deliverance. One of the great things that you can see in this is that she was inside of a city with strong walls, good defenses, good defensive situation. You know, for some cities that have great defenses throughout history, you know, unless they had some sort of fantastic siege equipment, which, you know, hear a lot of descriptions of siege equipment in Numbers or any of that kind of conquest of the land. But unless you have some fantastic siege equipment, a people inside of a city, especially when big walls and such, can hold out for quite a long time. You know, that you might have a siege that goes on for long time, months or years, depending on the city. But inside of a city is a fantastically great defensive situation. But for her to say, oh, we've heard about what the God of Israel has done. Now note what she says. She talks about open the sea. That was 40 years before. And then the Sihon and Og, that was actually relatively recently. So over a 40-year period, what has happened has definitely come to the minds of the people. And you can see from the reaction of this, the king or the chieftain there of Jericho, that you know he was pretty freaked out that they were coming in to come spy out the land. But it's very interesting that for her, her decision was that, okay, I know who the real God is, the real deity, and it's with you. Not with us, it's with you. So I'm willing to basically betray my own people here and put my lot in with you. These people that have been wandering around the desert and just recently have now started to take down chieftains across the river and such like that, across the Jordan. So that's quite an amazing shift. But, Well, you think of the time period of where this was. This was at the end. So we've fast-forwarded after the wandering. So this is 40 years later from where we're reading there in Numbers before. So this is quite a fantastic turn. And we've seen this throughout history, that you've had people who have seen that perhaps the, quote, invaders coming in are actually deliverers that are delivering from a worse situation, a worse condition. Now we could, you know, people have cast all kinds of aspersions toward Rahab over time, you know, basically since she's called a zonah, a promiscuous woman, that's casting all kinds of aspersions. However, what is it that you see the account of her throughout the Bible? Very, very high. Very high. You see her mentioned a couple times later on in Joshua, and then you see mentioned in the genealogy there in Matthew 5, 1, verse 5, there in the genealogy of Yeshua. Then you have it in Hebrews and in James, you know, where Jacob writes about her great faith. And Jacob, the apostle, even stacks her up and compares her with Abraham. So he gives an example of Abraham's faith and Abraham's trust in God. And then says, well, just in like manner was hers. So what she did was not significant. I should say, what she did was not significant after the fact, but what she decided to do at that moment was not insignificant, because that one change that she decided to make would not only change the history of the land in that area at the time, but also would change her direction in life. You know, some tradition goes on that she went off to marry Yehoshua and then became ancestors of prophets and priests. But we know at least that she was in the line of the Messiah, as it's listed there in Matthew. And also of note, and we might say is someone a bit of a salacious history, is Tamar. And she's also listed in the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, verse 3. So These people who you say, oh, they lived, you know, pretty scandalous lives. But what did that matter after they decided to put their total trust in the direction that God was going on? Yes, we have a statement over here. Yeah, that was a very pivotal moment that she decided to make.
What it also shows is that it doesn't matter what your background is, God will include you in his kingdom. It's not about your past, it's about where you are and where you want to go.
Yeah, that whole thing that Paul talks about with the new man and the old man. Now, a lot of us try to drag around the old man for a long time and resurrect the old man and give him CPR and such like that. But really, this is a good history that her past became some great future. That was a big, huge change that happened in her life. But one of the things that you also see happening in her life is this. Look for a moment in a couple of these examples, like in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19. When, again, remember Hebrews chapter 11 was called that hall of faith, and starts out there talking about, you know, that faith is the evidence of things not seen and for what you hope for. And then the description of all these people that follow being examples of that. So as you scroll down in this to verse 19, you see that this picture is fantastic. Hebrews 11, 19. Because that is actually one of the things that you see a great picture of what the hope that she had. Because first off, you see this picture of Abraham there in verse 19, where it says that he went through with what he did because he knew that even God could bring him back from the dead. Then you scroll down later in verse 30 and 31. And by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. So you got two faith things happening there. The first faith thing was that the people were going around for 7 days. And as you read on with that description of the fall of Jericho, that they were given the instruction to just march around it for 7 days, not say anything. And on the seventh day, around it seven times, and the last time around, you know, shout and blow the shofars, and then things happened after that. God did the work of taking down the city. But again, think of this. This is 40 years later. They've gone from people that decided, oh no, the city is too big, we can't take them, to now we're going to take a city by just walking around it and then making some noise. And then the city is going to fall down before us. That's quite a difference in what was like when you talk about the old man is where we were reading there in Numbers of when they heard the report, oh, these people are big, their walls are high, we can't do anything about them, to now 40 years later, the new man of Israel is like, okay, God says, we just walk around it and then walls are going to fall down? Okay, we'll do it. And yes, we have another comment. Yes, so they were like totally silent. So
they couldn't have any doubt or unbelief or negative things coming out of their mouth.
Yeah, no grumbling either.
Which I think is why, you know, and that's probably why he told them to be quiet or silent.
Yeah, and you can also think about what kind of an intimidating thing that would be to have this huge group of people just walking quietly around, because that's not how sieges were usually done. You know, and you hear the accounts of sieges, whether you're talking about in the Far East or in Europe or in the Middle East, that was not how sieges happened. And they came at you with everything. And if they couldn't just swarm over the walls, then they would try to bash the walls down. So to just have people walk around the walls. And then think about, like, for those first 6 days, they walked around the walls and then left. Yeah, what army does that? It's like, okay, and it's not a quite a... private, or you could say covert scouting operation, have a huge group of people march around and then leave. And then come back the next day, march around and then leave. And next day, march around and then leave. It's like, wow. That's really quite amazing when you think that is how they approached the second time around. Because you saw in the account when they tried to go up in Numbers chapter 14, when they were said, okay, you don't think you can take it? Well, you're right. You can't take it. You're not going to go in there, and you're going to go march around in the desert for 40 years, for 40 days of spying that you didn't trust, and you didn't trust me. Then they tried to go up and then they got whooped. Then 40 years later, they came back and like, okay, this is the way that God is going to approach this kind of a conquest. So one of those things that we can take a great lesson out of this is, you know, how do we approach anything that is a Jericho in our life? Are those some of those things that you just think are too big, too strong, or too few of us? We don't have the right equipment. We don't have the right this. We don't have the right that. It's not the time to go. You know, we're thinking here, we're coming up on the 4th of July, and we think about the independence of our country. This is talking about going back to 1776 and our Declaration of Independence from Great Britain. But we think of another pivotal time in history with just a little bit earlier in June there with D-Day. Now, D-Day was a kind of an experience of like, do you move or do you stay or what do you do? And the accounts that you have of D-Day, the famous quote of, well, on this beach are only those who are dead or about to die. Those people that would not move forward were toast unless they decided to move forward. And a lot of us really can face the same thing in moving forward with what we do. You know, the simple, quote, simple, unquote, thing that Messiah has told us to do is take up your cross daily. And I'll say, well, okay, what is that cross? Is our cross staying away from a box of donuts? Or what is it, our cross? Well, if you think of what a cross is that those things that are put to death, the things, your old life that needs to be put to death. Is that the challenge that we're going at? Do we just stay put? If we stay put, we're toast. Because if we stay put, we will be overcome. That's one of the things that God teaches us, is to move forward. When he says, you can do this. I put my spirit within you. You can do this. You can move forward. Go, move forward. Don't stay put. You stay put, you think you're going to hide and avoid what's coming against you? No. You know, those who think they stand firm, be careful, you're about to fall. Yeah. That's kind of the situation of thinking that you have everything in place and you can survive on your own. Well, no. No, you can't. And that was a 40-year lesson that Israel had to learn between the old man and the new man going into the land and realizing that, yeah, going into the land, walls are too high and the people are too big if it's just you going in. But if you take the creator of heaven and earth in there with you, no person is too high. No walls are too high. It's like nothing to knock them down and to take them out. Yes? Who wrote the book of Joshua? Well, there's a number of ideas on that. Some might think that some of the later scribes, some people have put it with some of the prophets. So, you know, some of the accounts you have seem like they're contemporary. And some seem to be reflections and time places of things later. So, yeah, don't know, but there are contemporary details and stuff in there that can point us to where the origin of that may have been. Yeah, you had an observation?
Oh, just the, when it says trust, it refers back to when God said, these are my commandments. If you do this, I will do this. If you don't do this, then I will do this. So trusting is to know that God is going to do what he said he would. So if you want blessings, you do what he tells you to do, and then you trust that he's going to do the blessings that he told you to. It's like when they were in Jericho, and according to the blessings, he said, I will put to flee your enemies if you obey my commandments. So when
when we were reading in Hebrews, and they were trusting God for doing something, is because they believed Him. They believed in the commandments, and then they totally trust in what God said. So that's their faith. That was their trust in Him. So I thought that was, you know, before I came here, I was just like faith, you know, just. It was almost like a good wish that I had in my head. Like, you know, I have faith in that God is going to give me a Rolex. But that's not how it works. It's about God's will, God's commandments. When you ask anything with His will and in His will, then He will do it for you. But if I ask, hey, God, can I have a tiger? It's a pet. Please, I have faith. I believe in you. I confess it, I declare it. It's like, no, that is not going to happen because it's not His will. So it's just what I wanted to comment about faith is it's trusting in something that God said He would do. And then that's faith. He said it, so now you trust in Him, and then He will do it for you.
That's why one of the things that Yeshua quoted to the adversaries, you know, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. You know, what is it that you trust? What does you have trust in? And those things that you have trust in, are they trustworthy? And that's one of those things that ended up with this rebellion that we were reading about there in Numbers chapter 14, is that did they remember? And that remembering connected with actual action. Because that's one of those things that, you know, we're warned about so many times throughout Scripture, is that, you know, if you think that you are going along fine, you could be getting ready to fall because you forget not only the problems that you had in the past with your old life, but you also forget how God took you through those things and changed you from that sort of person that you used to be. You know, if you used to be a pathological liar, how God transformed you into, you know, being truthful, even if it like hurts you in your sense of wanting to weasel out of some things, which means, you know, taking responsibility if you end up goofing up on something and say, yes, I goofed up, not trying to tell a story and get yourself out of it. And whatever our old life used to be, to really just face up to that. But face up to it in realizing where we have come from. Yeah, Rahab would never have gone any further if she was like, I am this Zona and that's all I'm ever going to be. That is my lot in life. You know, to think of what her option was, is to then move out of that life that she was in to some other life. When we talk about, quote, salvation and deliverance, that is it. Going from the old life to the new life. And this new life is everywhere you want to be, this kingdom of God. It's when we talk about where we want to be and having faith in God, do we truly ever want to be there anymore? And that is kind of where we're getting to in Numbers chapter 15 with the guy collecting sticks. It's a little bit about what's behind that. Do you want to be in the kingdom of God? And it's a little bit behind of what you see there in the end of Revelation, where, and it's a little kind of a picture also at the end of chapter 14 of Numbers, where after being told by God, you can't go in, then they tried to go in. And I've always thought it was kind of curious when you read Revelation and it talks about where these people then try to attack the city of God. You're like, what kind of craziness is that? And it's like after you've been like, okay, you're out. You're not in the city. Then you go try to attack it because you realize, oh, I'm not in the city. I've been left out. That's one of those key things in life. We'll be getting to it in just a little bit of a moment, but in Hebrews 3 and 4, it keeps saying today, 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 today. Don't harden your hearts. Today, go in, go into the land, go in. Enter his rest. Don't delay, don't equivocate. March in. God says, you got this, go in. Your old way of life is gone. Go in. Rahab, you're not a Zonah anymore. Go in with these people. That's one of these, the great pictures that we have of this new life, the entering the kingdom of God. It's a different than where we've been before. And we'll get to this in a little bit of a moment too, but it will also be different from the way things may be around us. Because one of the things that we have the option of, we have the option of going forward with God into a world that's very hostile to God, or we can hide our relationship with God, or we can just blend in with the nations around us and say, well, you know, it's too hard to fight against. Too hard to fight against the world. Very similar to what we have there with the people of Jericho. If you know that these people are coming in and what they did to the kings of Sihon and Og, what do you do? I mean, you'd think the prudent thing, if you actually believe those accounts, was to make a peace treaty. To make a peace treaty and do something about this. But one of those things that you could say is an example of a heart that you could say knows the truth but just doesn't want to go with it. That's a little bit of what you face in these kinds of situations. And it's a little also picture of, you could say, a mission of the kingdom of God that even though, as you read the end of Deuteronomy, it's saying, when you go into the land, wipe it all out. Clean this slate. Yet, the spies went in there and they found Rahab. And Rahab was spared with her and her family. There's some commentators who say, oop, well, that was, you know, they got these spies playing fast and loose with God's instructions. Or is it God's mercy? Because you see what the person who Rahab became, that was God's doing. Yeah. Was there, yes, Bill.
Somewhere in the New Covenant, I can't remember just where it was, but it says, remember, recall the joy you had when.
Yes, when you remember your first love also.
Remember, yeah. And don't forget it. You get down and out 40 years later, start trying to remember that back again. See how joy you had then and get it back.
Remember the joy of your salvation.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember the joy of your deliverance. Right on. You know, can you imagine the transformation that we've had in our lives? When I talk about, you know, thinking back to what God has done in our lives, when we think that we can't do it anymore, just look back into where God has taken us this far. And then, and I know that that's one thing that helps me, you know, be able to move forward when I'm like paralyzed, either with fear or laziness or, you know, apathy or just, you know, I'm, quote, too tired anymore to go any further. Just thinking back, just like, okay, I got through this and it was better on the other side. The entering God's rest is the better option than to stay put, try to fight against it and such. Kind of like, you know, in a kind of a very simple sense, it's like, you know, when you're very young, fighting taking a nap. And then when you get older, it's like, man, you wish for your next nap. And that's one of those things when you fight going into the rest and it's like, wow, the rest is the best thing that ever happened to you. And we're all a lot like that. And that's really what the book of Hebrews is a lot about, is don't fight it. God is taking you somewhere where you need to be. Don't fight it. Yes.
Also, it was an odd contrast between the Numbers 15, which kills the man, dies from the sticks, being killed by the sticks, right? Or not by them, because of them. Because he got the sticks on Shabbat. Yet, in Joshua's time, all the men are commanded to go to war on Shabbat.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because there's 7 days of the Jericho. One of those days has to be a Shabbat, by definition. Yeah. And at that time, it's perfectly acceptable, because God said go do this, and they all go do it. But it seems really strange, very odd contrast between the two. One, the man does it on his own, he's executed. And then one, everybody does it, and if they're instigating a war, not like they're defending themselves, they're actually attackers. And God says, yes, go do this. Go ahead, that's a good thing. It just seems so bizarre.
Well, let's move toward that. In Numbers chapter 14, one of the things you see there is this intercession after the people start, you know, freaking out after they hear the report of the 10 spies that definitely gave one-star reviews of the land and their prospects of doing anything about it. They started saying, oh, we want to go back. We want to go back. We want to go back to Egypt where it was just so nice and we lived in comfort on our lazy boys all day long. But one of the things that you see in Numbers chapter 14 is a great picture of this intercession where Moshe, the first part of the chapter, you know, he's in there interceding. And it's a really a great picture for us is that, you know, are we interceding? For example, for those inside of our family who are just not getting it and not being oppressive against us, kind of, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where they talk about sibling rivalry. It's like you get angry at each other because you, quote, can't help it, unquote. You just irritate each other too much. And it's like in those sorts of situations, are we interceding for each other? It's like, Lord, have mercy on us. Mercy on them. They don't know what they're doing or what. They just don't see the direction they're heading in. We think about our brothers and sisters in the body of Messiah. And too easy for us to say, oh, well, how could they be so whatever? But the point is that we were all there once. We all, you know, weren't as close to Messiah or far away from Messiah. We were this, we were that, we thought this, and then thought better of it, this and that and the other. The thing is, we should be interceding for each other, like Moshe was. It's like, have mercy on all of us. Have mercy on us. And one of those things that not only just in what you think or the teachings of it, but also, some of the things that are happening either in the body of Messiah or in our country, in our community, you know, the things that are, you know, God considers disrespectful or things that are self-destructive are now called, you know, blessed and self-actualizing. You know, reaching your full potential, becoming who you really are. Those sorts of things also. Are we interceding with God for mercy for that? That the eyes be open. Because remember, the Apostle Paul came to that realization there. In chapter 11 of Romans, it's like, wow, I guess God has done something where he's just blinded them. And interceding for them, it's like, okay, praying for the time when God is going to lift the veil off of them and they'll be able to actually see what the real deal is. And that prayer should be for everybody in our family and in the greater body of Messiah, the greater family of God, that eyes will be open and hearts will be open, hearts will melt. And that picture, you know, we've been talking about Hebrews 3 and 4 a lot because of that. And you see this great picture because it's a picture that really fits in with this parasha here because it's dealing with the period and the heart situation of rejecting The rejection of entering God's rest, not going into the place where he says, okay, this is where you can truly find rest. And that's Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 8 through 16. I guess, sorry, verse 7 is probably a good one. He again fixes a certain day, today, saying, through the weed, after so long a time, just as has been said before, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Yehoshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. There remains a Shabbat rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his. Therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest, so that no one will fall, through following the same example of disobedience. For the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing as far as the division of soul from spirit, from joints and marrow, able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Therefore, since we have such a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Yeshua, the Son of God, let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. That's a good picture of what Moshe is doing here in the beginning of Numbers chapter 14. It's a kind of a prefiguring of the role of the great high priest and interceding. As you know, Yeshua knows what it's like to shrink back. That tendency to want to shrink back from this. We see examples of that in the garden. Three times when he's like, hey, take this thing from me. Take it. This is too much for me to bear. Take it. But again, not what I want, but what you want. Not what I want to do, but what you want to do and your plan for it. And you know, Hebrews in chapter 10 talks about that we should not shrink back. Shrink back from what? Shrink back from our Yeshua, our salvation, the one who is bringing us in, is delivering us, and will deliver us. Don't shrink back from that. Because if you try to shrink back from that, good luck entering God's rest without that. Good luck with that. It's just like there in Numbers 13, when God says, if you trust me, you can go in, but if you don't, you're toast. Didn't want to trust God, thought they were toast anyway. Then when God says, yep, you're toast, then try to go in, and they were toast. So, lots of toasting. One of those things that we can get out of this is that God knows what it's like to face something that is just huge, that we can't move. Our old way of life and the things that come up in our daily lives, whatever those struggles we have with family or our coworkers or bosses or finances or whatever, those things that we struggle against, those big walled cities, so to speak, God knows that they look scary. But he's got a way that we can get around them. Even if it thinks like it just seems like a crazy way to go about it. Like the people walking around Jericho for 7 days. Seems like a crazy way to take a city. But that was exactly the way that they were going to take that city. And in Hebrews 3 and 4, they talked about this on other occasions, but just as a little bit of a recap, because we'll see this again in a few chapters in Numbers, where Moshe finally is, the reason he doesn't go into the land is because of an encounter at Meribah. Massah and Meribah factor in big in Israel's history, like just like this thing we're seeing here about the spying out the land. And it's the incident that is really captured upon in Hebrews 3 and 4 comes from Exodus chapter 17, but the incident there of finding, they're just come out of the Red Sea and they're looking for water, can't find water, and then they find places that it's not safe to drink, bad water. And the big thing there was, do you trust God or not? Do you trust that he took you all this way through all this stuff and he's just going to let you, you know, die of thirst in the desert? It's like, yeah. Do you trust where God is going and where God is leading? And that is what the backdrop of Hebrews 3 and 4 is. That rest. Do we trust where God is actually leading us? And you could say the lesson is, where was God leading us through all this? Leading us to the Messiah Yeshua, who was the actual salvation, described even as, you know, the rock where water sprang from, described also as the cloud that followed them, the protection that was coming through with Israel. This is where God was leading them. But these various things he thought were not the way that a people should operate, the way some new, quote, movement, new nation should operate, but that was the way that this nation was going to operate, because this group of people was going to be different. They were going to be a magnet. They were going to be the beacon, this big searchlight going out into a dark world where to show people, hey, there is a place where you actually need to be. So we get on into chapter 15 of Numbers. And we, just a brief note here before we get into the Shabbat issue. In the beginning part, verses up through verse 31, they're talking about these offerings and such. And we've talked in Leviticus a bit about the various offerings. But just something to observe here on this, talking about the drink offerings, is that this is something that the Messiah and the Apostle Paul latched onto quite a bit with this picture of the drink offering and comparing that with actually, you know, themselves and their offering. Because as we talked about in Leviticus, the korban, which is offering, means, you know, to approach. And the korbanot is all about the ways of approaching the presence of God. And that being a picture that you yourself are approaching the presence of God by way of these symbols of the various offerings. And one of the pictures there of the drink offering, you know, being like blood being poured out. And you see the Messiah mentioned this quite a few times, three examples there, like right before his death there, it's Passover time, Luke 22, verse 20, he says, "This cup is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." So that pouring out has got a very specific kind of mention, imagery. When you're talking about pouring something out, is a picture of a drink offering. Because as we saw in the account, part of the offerings that were being given was this drink that was poured out there at the altar. And he mentions again in Mark chapter 14, verse 24, that this, his pouring out was to be poured out for many people. And again in Matthew 26, 28, that this pouring out was going to be for the forgiveness of sins. So when we think about the various ways we get into this, and you think about the drink offering, the things that were being poured out, this is like someone's life being poured out. You think of all the blood that went out with the animals that were going on the altar, but life was being poured out. And we think of the chief life that was poured out for us in the blood of the Messiah. Through his life being poured out, we have life. But then also, the Apostle Paul latches onto this as like, okay, we ourselves are poured out. For example, in Philippians 2, 17 and 18, he kind of mentions this as of his life being poured out like a drink offering. And again, in 2 Timothy 4, 6, he says, as he's kind of coming near the end of his life, he says, "I am already poured out like a drink offering." So this picture of the pouring out of the drink offering, you can think of it as kind of like giving everything out. Because if you have a container that's full of something, once you pour it out, it's gone. Especially pour it out on the ground. You can scoop up the mud and stuff and put it in, but that's not what you started with. Same with the burnt offering. When you burn it up, it's gone. It's just all up. When you eat up the bread offerings and the grain offerings, it's gone. You are giving your whole self into this. Which gives us a picture to what Alma, you brought up before about the way that we live is by, you know, listening to what God says and going forward with what God says. But that going forward with what God says is to go all in, to put everything into it. Not holding something back. Another picture we'd see from later on with the conquest of Jericho, with those people who went in and they took stuff that was in there. And they were told that everything was supposed to go up inside of Jericho. They took some stuff that was in Jericho and they held something back. We saw the account in our last time we were speaking there about, you know, Aeneas and Sapphira. And they said that they were going all in. They were giving everything from that land that they sold. But no, they weren't. They held something back. They didn't have to sell it. They didn't have to say they were giving an offering, but they were giving an offering and saying, hey, we're giving it all. No, they weren't. So a good example of where we go forward is, you know, we don't want to be stuck cowering in front of whatever things that we face. We just got to push forward. Because if you stay stuck in the midst of an attack, you're vulnerable. You move forward or you retreat. And kind of the lesson there of Hebrews at the end of it is that if you retreat from your only source of actual deliverance, then good luck with that. In the end, talked about there in Revelation, you know, if you pass by, the only way that this planet has out of the direction it's going, then there is no other way about that. It's like someone who wants to remain in a house when you have a highway going right through the house. You can choose to remain in the house. But if the highway indeed has to go through that, you know, you can't stay in the house any longer. Yeah, I know, bad example. They can always route the house around, route the freeway around it, and they've done crazy things like, you know, put an overpass over the top of a house and stuff like that. So, but the point being is that if there is no other way around it, you know, you either go forward or get lost. And the sad thing is that we do come up with those things in life. We don't want to be some of the things that people have tried to characterize the society in which we live, and even disparagingly call some of the newer generation, you know, Generation Snowflake, because they cannot take any sort of stress, otherwise they fold. Well, in life you're going to face stress. Everything. Life is stress. Life is hard. The point is that how do you approach your life? And you approach it as you yourself have entered rest and you're just going forward through it. No matter what anything throws at you, you are still at rest. You still know where you belong. You know where you're going. You know that you're going to get there even if you don't see where the end is. Or do you just run around cowering in fear from every little thing that bumps up against us, thinking that that is the end at every little moment? You know, it's where some of the obsession with nihilism and destructionism and stuff comes from, is the impending fear of death, impending fear of death, of any last moment can be your last moment on earth, and that's the end of everything. Well, then you're afraid to move, afraid to do anything, or you just like go through everything as hopeless. Why care about anything? So one of the things that the picture, the great lesson we get from this is look up from our navels and look out toward over the horizon where God has taken us, to where He's going. He has us going. Because that's what gets us through. That's what got our forefathers in faith through when they were facing huge challenges. Today, when we read about our brothers and sisters in countries where just being saying, yeah, I believe, even if you're nominal, they come after you and kill you. That's what gets them through. That trust, that over the horizon, past where we can see, is where we want to be. And that we don't have to wait to be at rest and to know we are content with everything. That's great. So getting on to the Shabbat issue, which the reason I kept delaying this was so that we can get through the Hebrews part, because that was key to what's going on with this Shabbat issue there. Why is that so important? Because of what the memorial of Shabbat is. It's a sign, but a sign of what? And he mentions several things throughout the Bible. You know, think of back there in Genesis chapter 2. It's a sign of what? It's a sign that He is the creator, the one who started things. It's a lot of confusion today about where does everything come from. And next, it's a sign of deliverance. You see that in Exodus, where it talks about that this is the Shabbat is a sign of deliverance. Well, a lot of people are confused, thinking that you don't have anything to be delivered from, and not realizing what sort of bondage you're in, not realizing that you're not at rest and you're restless, always trying to look for something new. And actually, people flocking to the meditational disciplines, the transcendental meditation or Eastern meditations, where you just seek to find rest by emptying yourself of everything. But in the end, and trying to find the peace within yourself. But this is talking about finding peace with the one who actually made things and is the great example of all of the order that we see around us, and moving forward with that. Another sign of Shabbat is that God is the one who heals us. He's the one who makes us holy, who sets us apart. We are not set apart because we follow Shabbat. We follow Shabbat and respect Shabbat, keep Shabbat, because God set us apart. He made us holy. We don't make ourselves holy by following Shabbat. That's one of those things where it becomes quite confusing in Paul's letter of Galatians if you don't catch his point. Paul's point there being that Shabbat and the Torah are not the things that get you right with God. God sets you right, then you just say, oh, what do you want to do? Yes, sir, what do you want to do? What is the kind of mentality we go in? You know, I've never been in the military, but I always respect people who have been in the military, because the idea of moving forward just because someone says go, that is just an amazing thing. Especially when I heard from like my uncle, and he served in World War II in Italy, and hearing his accounts of just moving forward into unbelievable carnage. Wow. To just respect someone because they are worthy of respect. You trust them. You trust them that, hey, he's looking out for you. And that's just a human example. You know, our earthly commanders may not have the whole thing in view, but our heavenly commander has everything in view. So do we trust him and move forward? It's a lot of what Shabbat is. So then when you look in Revelation there, chapter 13, when it talks about, worship him who created the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them. What is the memorial of that? The memorial of that is the Shabbat. One of the last great things that we see that God says is coming on this earth are people that forget who created everything. Well, what is it that we see here today? A large-scale forgetting or willful ignorance of where things actually come from. When actually things are becoming ever more clear as we know more about the world that things do come from a source and a cause, not the uncaused. So that is kind of the backdrop of what Shabbat is. Shabbat is a weekly memorial of who everything comes from, where we're going, how we get there. All that stuff is wrapped into that. So we get to this experience, and it's kind of interesting that in Numbers chapter 15, where it talks about this just right after, it talks about these. The first part of the chapter, pretty much, is talked about up through verse 29 of chapter 15, is talking about doing things unintentionally. People doing things unintentionally. Unintentional, unintentional, unintentional. Then until it gets up to verses 30 and 31. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord. Now, blaspheming is just a big word for to make common, to make nothing special. In some cases, make less than special, less than common. To actually be disparaging, but just generally making things not special. So you got that contrasted defiance and making not special. That's the key thing of defiance in this. So you'll notice that it says unintentional, unintentional, unintentional. And then it says defiance to make God of less importance, to bring his stature down. Now those in some things are, that goes to quite a huge level of, you say, acting out against God. So with this then goes right into the destruction. Oh, there was this guy, they were out in the desert, he was collecting sticks. It doesn't say specifically when this was, but this has been grouped right here on purpose. So sometime when they're out in the wilderness that this happened. And it's placed here, likely, because we are meant to connect these two ideas of God having a way to cover people that do things unintentionally. And just, I think, in looking at the gravity of the situation here, is that realm of the unintentional, God has a lot of grace in there. There's a lot of grace and mercy in that word unintentional. So he's not like has his finger over the smite button. To get to the smite button in the, you know, cutting off from the people, that has to go well beyond something else. So just in the picture of how this is sequenced together, how this is presented to us here, 13, 14, 15. This is telling me that the picture that we're supposed to get here is something related to God says, no, don't enter the land. This guy is defiant. And this picture that I have in my mind is that this guy is mad. He's mad that he's out there. Maybe he's in that generation that has to wander and has to die. And in that context, then going and say, oh yeah? Well, I don't care what it is you say. I'm just going to go do this anyway. So disregarding, you know, when you think of Shabbat is supposed to be this great memorial that spans all the way to the beginning of creation, the beginning of time, that this is a memorial of and what God has been doing ever since then. And, you know, to use a, you could say the vernacular here, this is a really giving God the finger, middle finger. It's that kind of defiance and saying, well, I don't care who you claim to be. I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. So, you know, when we think about Shabbat and the thing, okay, stop what you're doing. Stop. There are people who pay lots of money today to go on these meditational retreats, to go and do nothing. Stop. Meditate. Just, you know, go into their mantras for hours and hours and hours, days on end. Okay, people pay a lot of money to do that. And God is saying, look, one day in seven, just stop. Stop what you're doing. And not just stop and try to clear yourself from everything so that you will, whatever that's inside of you will then come up and you will be able to to become self-actualized by getting enlightenment upon yourself and your situation. But this is, stop what you're doing and remember. Remember, reflect, get perspective. Where things come from, where you're going, who is actually making you holy, who is actually healing you, who's actually delivering you. Get perspective on all that. Today, people are really striving for this perspective and seeking to find it in, you know, becoming one with either themselves or whatever they might try to do through meditation. Well, Shabbat, I'm not saying Shabbat is meditation. I'm just saying that it is what God is saying is a stopping point. To stop the flow of where your whole life is going, trying to put food in your face, try to keep the bill collectors away from you, you know, keep the boss off your back and that kind of thing, just to stop and gain perspective. So in all that, then you've got this guy and he is out disrespecting. You know, we can come up with various ways we think he's disrespecting as he, you know, in the process toward sparking a fire, which God says, you know, that's something that's related to, you know, the temple and such like that, don't do it. Or is he carrying, picking up stuff, and quote, harvesting, which is something related to priestly activities that shouldn't be done on Shabbat related to the tabernacle? Or is he carrying something related to those things related to the temple? Whatever it was, it started in this guy's heart and it goes back to defiance against God. This, you know, that's where you have to have things into perspective on where this is going. And the extraordinary nature of this should be quite evident in this, that they locked this guy up to figure out what to do with him, because this had apparently never happened before. You know, you think of all the inadvertent things that we've done because we've forgotten this. Oh, it's like, oh my goodness, yes, I forgot this and forgot that. And it's like, wow, I shouldn't have done that. You know, you may have forgotten the birthday of somebody's significant, forgotten an anniversary or whatever it is, you might have forgotten something, but you didn't intend any sort of slight or anything from it. And then when you remember it, it's like, oh, wow, I did something really bad. And then, you know, you could say, repented from it, pulled back from it, said, I got to do something so that never happens again. That happens all the time. And you see that throughout Israel's history of people doing stuff and thinking better of it and pulling back from it, this and that and the other. This is like, wow, this is something that just has not happened before. So we got to like lock this guy up and figure out from God what it is that we're supposed to do now. That's the gravity of this. So I don't know, Pat, if that kind of helps explain kind of why, because on the surface, yeah, you're right. You look at this, it's like picking up sticks and then we kill him. And to the world out there that would have no respect for the Creator or where the Creator of the everything is wanting to take things, you know, it really seems trivial and really spiteful. But in the sense of saying that this is something very special to keep in the memory of the world, because you think of today, here we are, you know, what? Probably a good, you know, 3,500 years at least removed from the situation we're talking about here. And yet we still have the words of God here because of the things of guarding, keeping special, these things, these words that come to us from the Creator, from His Messiah, all the things He's done. Guarding and keeping these things special was essential to, you could say, the survival of the planet. Because if these things had not been considered to be special, to be considered essential to the survival of everything on Earth, then we would have lost them and we would have not had anything like this. So those things, you know, in a small sense, you have it like in genealogy. In times past, in generations past, people would write down You know, it was a common thing, like in your family Bible or before that in other records and such, who begat who, and on and on and on it goes down. So you'd have lineages on going back generations and generations and generations. Today, people don't really care where it is you come from. I mean, unless you've done serious work, do any of you really know, like maybe past, maybe grandmother, maybe great-grandmother, where it is you come from? A lot of us don't, because that's just, we don't think that carrying on things from generation to generation to generation, good and bad, is something worth retaining. But that is a part of what Shabbat is. It's retaining the knowledge of the Creator, the Redeemer, the Healer, the Sanctifier throughout time. And that's why it was so important to bring that forward. I don't know if that's helped at all. It's kind of one of those things where I know I did struggle with this at times past. And I remember first reading it, it's like, wow, that just seems pretty capricious to just kill somebody for collecting firewood. Because you think, oh, if you don't collect firewood, you don't. And that period of time, it could, depending on the time of year, it could have been for heat and obviously for food and this and that and the other. Well, how vindictive and petty would that be to kill somebody for doing that? But the point is that one of the lessons that was given to Israel throughout time is you've got 6 days to take care of things. That's plenty of time. I know as I keep telling myself, oh, I don't have time for this, I don't have time for that. Then I look at what I actually spend time on and I realize I've got plenty of time to do stuff. I just choose to spend time very unwisely in certain things. So that's one of those things that God's just saying. It's like, hey, get your priorities in order. What's really important in life? And then you'll have rest to move forward with real life. And real life is a part of the kingdom of God and moving that into the world. Because wouldn't everyone like to be able to have rest without trying to ponder and reach a state of nothingness, become one with nothingness, which is what the world seeks. The world seeks peace and rest. And God keeps crying out, hey, enter my rest today. Enter it. Don't want to be that generation that is left outside realizing when it's way, way too late, hey, I should have made time for it. I had plenty of time. I should have made time for it. So thanks be to God that He's given us mercy, that even when we were ignorant and foolish, that He still has had mercy on us to allow us to enter His rest. Yeah, you have a final comment here?
Yeah, about the gathering the sticks. It says that the man was, you know, he was executed for gathering sticks, and it says that, they were told not to, and that the man went about collecting the sticks anyway. And he says that because man will not be judged by what's in our heart; it's by what we do. And so when others see us doing it, which they say that he was warned, you know, other men warned him obviously because they weren't just going to out and out kill him. That they were warned, and what we are doing is digging a pit for another man. Is that we're showing the morale of that we're not keeping the Torah because we're out gathering sticks. So it was an offense to God because this man was obviously told by other witnesses. God just didn't strike him down dead. And it says that the Torah warns twice, emphasizes that he found him gathering sticks anyway, and he continued to gather them even after they found him doing so. So it was that. Is that when he did that, it was as though he was belittling God's name. Maybe not the word belittling, but he was.
Well, that's why they used the term earlier. They're talking about blasphemy, making it lesser.
Right, you're digging a pit for someone else, saying, okay, well, the Sabbath.
It's not really important.
It's significant. Right, that's what he was doing, and that's why God used him as an example, is because he said it was like digging a pit for another man, is that. Right, I guess, you know, he did it, so I might go do it. So I know that it's very hard. I know family members like, oh, you call yourself a Christian. But the thing is that you get upset because people are, we're human and we're fragile. If it gets too hot or if it gets too cold, and because we're human, we're not spirit yet. But when people are poked, you know, you react. And so that's two stories. But the man getting the sticks, that he was, God felt that he should be, because he was ruining it for the group. I wrote that down.
Yes.
Like I tell my children, why did God kill them? Or the order? They were in the desert. Have you been in the desert? There's no forest trees over there. It's a desert. God just saved them. The guy saw God opening the seas, and they saw the power of God. And God said before the Sabbath, he said, I'm going to test their hearts. I'm going to tell them, rest on the Sabbath day, get your double portion of manna. I mean, the guy seen that there's bread from heaven. And God gave the order, don't work on Sabbath, on the Sabbath day. What did the guy do? He went and gathered sticks. And I think we looked at the stick word before, and it doesn't mean sticks. It means like huge, big, oh, big pieces of wood. So if you're in the desert, and if you go and gather sticks, first of all, where are you going to find sticks? So the guy was actually working out of his way in disobedience. So that's why God killed him. So when I hear people saying, well, he was just gathering sticks. I mean, it's not like he went out of his tent and he was just sticks from the trees. There were no trees. So he was disobedient.
No, I mean, he could have been out doing whatever. The point was is that it started with his heart. His heart had left and was defiant against God, and it just happened to manifest itself in that way. Yeah. So that's one of those things that it becomes an incredibly hard lesson, because when you see, like, at the end of Revelation, where you could say that becomes the biggest sort of that one could say it's a capricious thing. Oh, you want to enter the kingdom of God and you go through by the Messiah, or God says, okay, you're a part of that which is finally going to be done away with, the old heavens and the old earth that he rolls up and does away with. That's at the finally the end of things. And you say, well, isn't that petty too? Because I didn't want to follow him versus some other deity or no deity whatsoever. Don't you think that would be petty? I mean, you could say that's almost as petty. But the point then comes in of the respecting the order of things and the long-term consequences of a going away from the way things are supposed to be in the order that it's set out. So, you know, when you have societies, just in a small little microcosm, when you have societies that decide to throw away their old traditions, to throw away law and order, they descend into anarchy and viciousness in quite a short period of time. You see some nations right now that have gone from stable, orderly to total disorder and chaos and killing people in the streets and dragging them out of their houses. And that's happened within 10 years, sometimes even far less time than that. That is what God is looking to finally do at the end when he says, it is finished. There will be time no longer. Is to finally put sin and death to an end, to get that totally and do away with that. Sadly, you know, there will be some folk that decide that they don't want to go that way. And that sadly is sometimes the choice that people make. If that's the choice you want to make, then that's the choice. Thankfully, God does not make robots. So if we don't want to be in his world, then He gives us that option. That's our choice. So we need to wrap up with things here today. Any last thoughts as we just close with prayer? Yes, Bill.
They're still trying to go over the wall instead of through the gate.
Yeah, like the thief and the robber, as the Messiah put it in the parable. Yeah, you don't try to go in through the way that's provided. You try to find some other way in. That doesn't often go well. Father, we thank you for giving us your words and for guiding us into your rest. And we thank you for giving us rest from all of the craziness around us and rest from wandering about, wondering where we really belong in life and what life is all about. We thank you for these things. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's hallel.info. Hillel.info.